Pad up. It's the Australian Cricket Podcast. And here are your hosts.
Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the Australian Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, a.k.a. Menners. And joining me for the first show of 2017, I have Joe. How are you, Joe?
Very well, Menners. How apt it is to have the originals here for the first show of the year.
And the other panellist is, of course, gun sports writer James McSmith. How are you, Macca?
Very well, Menners. Fantastic to be here. Thanks for having me, mate.
Now, we have got a massive show. We're going to review the extraordinary Boxing Day test. We're going to preview the Sydney test, which I've been getting in the mood for up at the SCG Nets the last couple of days. Not in the Nets, just watching people play cricket. And then we're going to do the commentary critique. We're going to look at the Big Bash. A lot to get through, but I thought before we get into all that, I want to sort of look ahead to this year, sort of broadly speaking, of what's ahead for the Australian cricket team and some of the major challenges. And obviously the first major challenge is the four tests in India for Australia. I don't give them any hope. What do you guys think?
Well, I think just a single test might be a good start in India. I think the recent tourists to India have struggled to avoid the whitewash. So if we can do that, I think it will be considered a success almost.
So not hopeful like me.
Manners, after 3-0 in Sri Lanka, I can't see anything but 4-0 in India personally, especially if Wade's going to be keeping.
And then from the tour of India, the Australians head over to England for the Champions Trophy, which is a one-day international tournament. It's a really compressed knockout-style tournament. And Australia have New Zealand, Bangladesh and England in their group. And they would have to win two of those three games. And just looking at that from a distance, you can see it's quite a tough group with the home side, England. And, of course, one of our bogey side, New Zealand. Are you guys excited about the Champions Trophy? Or is it one of those tournaments that you're a bit lukewarm about?
I thought they were canning it, Menners. What's the story there? Because, you know, with everything else on offer these days.
The story's there. I've just told you they're not canning it.
I know, mate, but there was talk the ICC were going to can it. Like, do we really need it?
I think we do, because we've seen with the way the 50-over World Cups are structured is they tend to go on for so long. They're not a great add for the 50-over game, whereas this Champions Trophy is that condensed, intense nature.
Fair enough.
What do you think, Joe? Lukewarm?
Yeah, I'm a bit lukewarm, Menners. I think, you know, we see so much one-day cricket these days that, you know, you need a good reason for it. I guess, as you say, getting the best ODI nations together in a condensed format might have some merit, but it seems like a bit of overkill.
And then moving on from that, there is no pre-summer tour for the Australians at this stage, which means we'll be at home preparing for the Ashes tour, unless Australia goes to Bangladesh that was cancelled two seasons ago.
Menners, would you go back? If you had the individual choice to go, would you go to Bangladesh?
Absolutely not.
Wouldn't even think about it. I can't see how that tour would go ahead. Who would want to go?
No one. And we saw what happened with Owen Morgan pulling out of the English tour there. Why would you want to go there and be locked in your hotel room and then ferried to the ground with it, tanks and the whole army taking you there and then brought back? I just don't think the Australian cricket team needs that.
No, Menners, I can't see that happening, and I think our focus is going to be on preparation for the Ashes series anyway.
And exactly, and then the year ends off with Australia's chance at regaining the Ashes on home soil. So we've dismissed our chances in India, but the second big series is the Ashes. Are we more confident about that one?
I'll tell you what I'm not looking forward about the Ashes is hearing KP commentate, which is certainly going to happen, isn't it?
Well, there's too much of KP commentating right now. Are you confident about the Ashes from this early stage, Joe? Or?
Yeah, well, the Poms look in a little bit of disarray, don't they? They're not even sure whether Alastair Cook's going to be the captain by that stage. So, you know, and I think we're on the rebound, so you'd have to like our chances.
Mez, can I just say that it could be a bit of a battle of two struggling sides, couldn't it, the Ashes? Not a battle for world supremacy.
Well, I don't know about the test rankings, but I'm pretty confident Australia will regain the Ashes this year. And this time next year, we'll have the little Ashes urn in the Australian cricket cupboard. Now, let's move on now and look back at the Boxing Day test. An extraordinary game that who of you here thought there was going to be a result after 3 days? Because I was super confident of going to the SCG for the first day of the third test, and it was going to be a 1-0 series in progress, and perhaps Pakistan could fight for a 1-1 series draw. And then all of a sudden, it was the Pakistan of old.
Well, I think least of all, Pakistan didn't think there was going to be a result. I mean, the way they let Mitchell Stark just take them apart was like you know, it was kind of like last day at the last hour at the fair, wasn't it? Nothing really matters. It was all a bit funny for mine. You know, they just sort of gave it away.
I think a lot can be taken from the fact that Misbah was saying after 2 days that they'd be happy with a draw, and Australia always have that attitude that any test is winnable. And I think that that was the attitude, and that's why the result turned out the way it did, is that we always believe we can win, and we play attacking cricket. I've actually generally been a little bit disappointed, you know, having heard such great things about the Pakistan team over the last 24 months with how Misbah's approached the series. He's missed a lot of tricks. I don't think he's used his bowlers particularly well. Defensive fields. And I think they, you know, they back themselves into a bit of a corner.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think you look at what happened at the Gabba, where they almost chased 490. The first innings at Boxing Day, they really worked hard to get a 400-plus score. It was just hard to see them collapsing in two sessions after all the good work they'd put in the previous few days of Test cricket. It just seemed weird that they would capitulate like that. But here's a stat that's going to blow your mind. In the whole history of Test cricket, there have been five instances of a team scoring over 400 in their first innings and then losing the game by an innings. Three of those five instances have happened in the last month.
What does that tell us, mate?
Well, it just tells you that I think teams are scoring so much quicker that they're giving themselves time to get the results regardless of whether the team in the first inning scores over 400. And I think, looking ahead to India, that could be what happens to Australia. We might bat okay and make 400 in our first innings, but then Virat Kohli and co are going to make 700 in 2 days, and you know, we'll have to bat on a minefield at the end. So I think that's what it shows. In a way, it was a textbook Aussie victory. Smith, Warner, tons. Stark crashing through Pakistan at the end. Just a textbook Aussie victory. The performances that you'd expect. The first innings for Pakistan was highlighted by Azhar Ali's 205. He's now the first ever Pakistani batsman to score two scores over 200 in 1 year. And I thought just looked immovable at the crease.
So classy. Great defense. And I love the way he plays his straight drive and his cover drive with minimal backlift and just all timing. He looks an absolute gem. Macca, what did you make of that innings? Just chanceless 200.
It was. I want to go back. Where was this fight? Where did it all unraveled after that, though, didn't it? I mean, I still can't get over that.
What happened in the second innings?
Yeah, I just, what went wrong? I just don't get over it because they set the game up so well, like you said, Joe.
Well, I think the you know, their big names in the batting order have underperformed all series, right? So, you know, if you look at Yunus Khan and Misbah, well, Huck, you wouldn't have expected that they would not have had a 100 by this stage in the series out of those two.
Because, of course, it was essentially a third, late third day, early fourth day pitch, wasn't it, when they got bowled out?
Mm.
Yeah, that's why I just couldn't see it happening. So we had Azhar Ali make a beautiful 205. Pakistan made 443. And again, we saw in this first innings for Pakistan that Australia lacked that fifth bowling option. And we'll look, when we look ahead at the SCG test, they've brought an all-rounder in, I think partly because they struggled with that fifth bowling option in this first innings. Josh Hazelnut took 3 for 50 off 32.3 overs. But the Pakistani batsmen worked really hard, 443 on the board, looked an imposing total. But then Australia came out and reeled off the highest ever test total at the MCG, 624 for 8. David Warner, 144 off 143 deliveries. An amazing innings. He hardly looked like he was really going hard, but he just kept working the ball into the gaps, hitting a boundary every now and then, and just reeled off another century at better than a runner ball. But I think something we predicted on the podcast before the series was Wahab Riaz's tendency to overstep. And that no ball to Warner, where he was bowled on 83, was costly in the end.
Yeah, I heard Waqar Yunus talk about it on the radio, and he was just apoplectic about it. He couldn't believe it. He said something's been going on throughout his whole career, and he just, you know, that kind of sums up in a way, you know, the little things that they did wrong, parts of their discipline, the drop catches, all that sort of stuff. Of course, it all adds up, doesn't it?
Yeah, and some of them were a foot over the line, not close no balls. He's nowhere near it. So I don't know how he does that. David Warner coming into this test match only averaged 24.22 at the MCG. So he had to get the bogey off his back, which he did. He's now passed 5,000 test runs and he's the sixth quickest Aussie ever to that mark. Another phenomenal innings from David Warner. And he was ably supported by Usman Khawaja, who made 97 again, his second score of 97 this summer. And I think a really good innings. But when you're sitting back at the end of your career and you look back at your figures, I think those 97s would really annoy you, and especially the shot he played. It was a bit of a windy whoosh outside off stump.
Yeah, loose shot. And we know it still is, you know, Michael Slater gets reminded of all of his 90s in retirement. So I agree. I think, you know, the one missing element of Khawaja, and I'm the biggest Khawaja fan out there, I think, you know, his technique is phenomenal. His application has been great.
Man, you've been a fan of his since the beginning of the podcast.
I absolutely have. But I don't know, maybe there's just a little bit of killer instinct missing in him. Like, you know, Smith or Ponting or so, the great batsmen through the years didn't let too many hundreds slip by, did they? Whereas he lacks a bit of intensity at times, doesn't he?
Certainly appears that way.
Well, I just think, you know, they talk about how he kind of revives memories of Mark Waugh's casual, lackadaisical approach. But I was actually surprised, Joe, that Khawaja, he didn't sort of go after that 100, you know, in the last over. I just couldn't really understand it. And I think the good thing was he was putting the team first, because unlike Shafiq in the Gabba test, thanks, man, is that, you know, Shafiq took those three runs and then put Wahab at strike and he fell, you know, before stumps, didn't he? So he's obviously protecting other batsmen, but I couldn't understand why he didn't sort of go for it. You know, it's obviously going to play on your mind no matter who you are when you're 100, when you're 95 or what, 90 odd overnight, isn't it? You come in the next day, you're not feeling so well, you wafted a loose one, it's all over.
You really have to start again the next
day. You do, yeah.
And unfortunately, it didn't happen for Khawaja, but a good contribution. But then, again, it was the Steve Smith show, and this is the Steve Smith stats segment of the show that is unplanned but seems to come up every week. Steve Smith made a magnificent 165 not out. He now averages over 60 in Test cricket. He went past 1,000 test runs for the year. It's the third year in a row he's done that. He's the fifth player to go past 1,000 test runs 3 years in a row. Matty Hayden did it 5 years in a row, which you look back and think, God, that was such a great achievement, 5 years in a row. Smith, it was his third test century in a row at the MCG. Four other players have done that. Don Bradman just did it seven times, you know, seven centuries in a row at the MCG. Don't think Smithy will catch that one, but surely Smith now is, you know, you got Bradman, then you got Smith.
Well, I think this is... Where's
Voges?
I can't remember such a huge transformation in somebody's career who reaches those heights either. I mean, this is a guy who was previously picked at number 8 in the batting order and picked for his, you know, potential in his leg spin bowling. And we're now talking about him in the same sentence as the likes of, you know, Greg Chappell, Don Bradman and Ricky Ponting. And if he goes on with this, you know, this momentum, he's going to be quite clearly our second best test batsman of all time. And I just think this innings was an example of where it looks like he's facing grade bowling sometimes. He's got so much time. He uses the crease. He's so difficult to bowl to. He's got every shot. He plays to every corner of the ground. And it just doesn't look like they're going to get him out.
Joe, I've got someone who that, you know, you talk about that evolution, the transformation, yeah, the metamorphosis. Oh, there's someone on the wall here in the studio. I think Steve Waugh, you can probably perhaps make that comparison because Steve...
is an all-rounder.
Well, yeah, and his bowling was as much at the forefront really early on as his batting, wasn't it? And it took so long for Steve Waugh to break through, and Steve Smith looked so ungainly in those first tests against England when we got absolutely clobbered, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
You know, they put their faith in both of these guys.
I was at the press conference and he was asked about that today. And there's some really interesting stuff. It's Steve Smith's 50th test match coming up at the SCG. And he was asked to reflect back on how he started his career as a bowler and then evolved. And he said he made a choice after his test debut around 2011-12 to really focus on his batting and move away from the leg spin. And he was really obviously happy with that, that decision. But then they were asked about why he's all of a sudden click to this mode of success, this unprecedented run. And he talked about a slight trigger movement he's added to his game in 2013 where he moves back and across. And it's so obvious. I mean, if you watch the replay, he moves quite almost a foot across his stumps just before the bowler's bowled. And he says that really sets him up to get in the right position to play the shots. And he only brought that in, you know, 3 years ago. But what I draw parallels with is the man you talk about, Steve Waugh, had the same trigger movement going back before Steve Waugh. The great Greg Chappell had the same trigger movement. So there is a common element of that trigger back and across. Ian Chappell was famous for it.
It's funny because we talk about him being, you know, Steve Smith being relatively sort of unconventional, but that back and across movement is what we're all taught as sort of first principles of batting. So it's interesting that that's what has sort of got him in the right position to play his shots. But the amazing thing about him is for all of his movement pre-delivery, he is so still at impact, isn't he? Like he is just, you actually look at his form when he makes contact with the ball and he's in perfect position most of the time.
Well, it's no fluke, is it, that he's averaging over 70 in Test cricket for the last 3 years?
And like Steve Waugh, I think he's just got such good hands, doesn't he? Like, he's got that shot. He's played a couple of back foot drives in this Test that were just... And there's only a couple of batsmen in the world that can do that.
Another player that's got a similar trigger movement to Steve Smith is Peter Handscomb. He made 54 in the Boxing Day Test, and it's his third 50-plus score in his first three consecutive Tests. Five Aussies have done that, including Michael Bevan. So great achievement for him. His lowest score in Test cricket when he's been out is 54. He's got two not outs. So Peter Handscomb's won for the team for a while.
Well, I think it's... Man, I think you're being a bit kind calling it a trigger movement. There's got to be something else, a bigger descriptor for what Handscomb does, because it's so damn ugly. It's like your man Bailey. I find it so hard to watch Handscomb bat.
Really?
Because of what he shuffles and he looks like...
The way he holds the bat behind...
He looks like he's about to chop the head off a cow or something. It's just... Isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just happy he's scoring runs. We need someone at five who can score runs. And then I think probably someone really unlucky not to get man of the match for the Boxing Day Test. Steve Smith was given man of the match, but I thought Mitchell Starc was a clear winner for the man of the match. And those of you who didn't follow the Boxing Day Test, when the fifth morning started, the only way Australia was going to get a result was if someone came out and scored some runs quickly. And Starc delivered in a big way, scoring 84 off 91 deliveries with 7 sixes, which is an MCG record, beating Andrew Simons, who will come up later in this episode. So Starkey, a quick 84, then comes out, takes some crucial wickets later on in the afternoon. I thought he should have been man of the match.
Well, some wag pointed out that he hit more sixes in that innings than Don Bradman hit in his entire career. But, man, I'd love to see him get 100 because he seems to wobble a bit. You know, I think when he got out for 99, whenever it was, he just couldn't put back to ball. And I don't know, did he get a bit of the wobbles once he got within touching distance of 100?
I don't know. I think he was just opening the shoulders, sure, wasn't he? He was putting the team first. So Pakistan came out. They literally had two and a bit sessions to survive. They were rolled for 163 in 53.2 overs. Starc 4 for 36, Hazelnut 2 for 39, Lyon 3 for 33, which we'll talk about. But before we get on to Lyon, the key thing that set up this dismissal, apart before Lyon's wickets, was just before lunch and just after lunch, Australia got a crucial wicket at each juncture. And I think that just put the wobbles in the Pakistan team. And then Lyon came on to bowl and he got Yunus Khan early, and then Misbah Ul-Haq came in and swept his second ball straight to short fine leg. And that was when you could tell this game was going down the gurgler for Pakistan. But crucial performance by Nathan Lyon probably saved his Test career.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think for two of the best concentrators in cricket, we've had Yunus throw away his wicket in the first Test, and now Misbah Ul-Haq play a pretty, you know, for a captain and his team being in that situation, quite a shot that lacked a little bit of accountability, didn't it?
Definitely. You don't want to see your captain doing that on his second ball.
No.
So crucial wickets for Lyon. Then the reverse swing kicked in and Pakistan were cleaned up. Great catching for Australia. I think we've seen since these young players have come into the side a real improvement in the fielding. And after the game, Steve Smith was asked, is this team getting closer to the finished product now? You know, we've had three Test victories in a row. What do you guys think about that?
Well, Wade's the big question mark here, isn't he? I mean, like, if this team is the finished product, he's not part of it.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, I find it so strange that previously the wicket-keeping position, you know, I've heard Gilly describe that as a generational position, in that you sort of get it, once you've got it, you have it for a generation, unless you do something, you know, horrific, or you drop catches like Wade did the first time round. But they can't now switch horses again to Neville. It'll just look ridiculous, won't it? You can't.
And that's the word I'm getting. I was trying to probe a bit down at the SCG what was going on with Wade, how tenuous his position was, but they're in no rush to move him on. And I think the way the team rallied around Wade when Maxwell made those comments, I mean, they're right behind him. He's got some supporters in the right spots.
Man, I think you'll find they'll take the, I don't know, the easy way out. And Wade, you know, he might be ousted by Neville for the tour match in India, and then he might not find himself in the first test team, or alternatively, he suddenly won't be there in the second test team. Instead of making sort of a public execution of getting rid of Wade, they do it overseas when, you know, when everything's away, when the footy season's starting to come in full swing, and there won't be such scrutiny. I can't see that Wade will be the keeper by the end of the India series.
Now let's look ahead now at the third test at the SCG. Australia have made two big changes. Nick Manton has been dropped. In comes young West Australian all-rounder Hilton Cartwright. Also, Jackson Bird has been left out of the 11, and they're playing a second spinner, Stephen O'Keefe. The way the SCG track is looking, there's a little bit of grass on it, but it will turn, and will turn pretty early. I think O'Keefe is an obvious selection, but Cartwright is a little bit from left field. He's only taken 4 Sheffield Shield wickets this summer, but he's scored 2 Shield centuries, so his strength is certainly his batting. What do you guys think of the young all-rounder being included at 6?
Well, man, it seems again, and I know, I think Darren Lehman's a big driver behind this, and we're obsessed with the all-rounder again. And I know for some guys can pull it off, but if you look at someone like Shane Watson, or if you look at Mitchell Marsh, I think some guys can really struggle having to excel at both disciplines. As you said before, Steve Smith let go the shackles of one. He decided to put his leg spin bowling to the side, and I just don't really understand this obsession for an all-rounder. And as you probably pointed out, Cartwright's not really an all-rounder, but he's going to fill that all-rounder spot. I don't understand. I think the reason that we had that we lacked a bit of balance in Melbourne early on was because Lyon wasn't bowling well.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think we need a batsman that can bowl 10 overs. And I think at the moment, the personnel at the top of the order, none of them bowl. And I think they're looking for someone at 6 that is a batting all-rounder that can just fill those 10 overs when Starkey and Hazelnut have bowled themselves into the ground and the second new ball's coming and you need someone just to tie up one end. Maybe he can do that job. I mean, Hilton Cartwright has done really well with the bat. He's only a young kid and he's really impressive. His first class average is 45. So with the bat, there's certainly the potential there.
I don't like interrupting the continuity of our pace attack when it's, you know, I think it's been one of the foundations of the turnaround of the side since Hobart. So, you know, it's extremely harsh on Jackson Bird. I think he's probably been, you know, he's been as impressive as the other two quicks in a lot of ways. So I think it's quite harsh on him. And I agree with Macca in that we've had this desire to force people into the all-rounder spot when you know, unless you've got somebody who's knocking the door down, which I don't think Cartwright has been, I don't understand why you have to do it. And with two spinners in the side, you know, that would have already taken the load off the quicks, right?
Then there's no one to bowl first change at all. True. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Look, I think they're also looking ahead to India and just seeing how they all gel together with that kind of balance, if we need to do that on the spinning tracks. I think Australia will steamroll Pakistan in this game. I just can't see them, the way they capitulated in Melbourne, I think this will be a pretty convincing victory for Australia. What do you think of players like Yuzir Shah? Someone came here with huge raps, but if he's going to do anything, this will be the track.
Well, exactly. So he'll get a Bunsen burner in Sydney, and really that's going to be his chance to shine. I've been pretty disappointed with him.
Well, did you see Warney's tweet with the figures of visiting spinners that come to Australia?
Yeah, I heard and it the way in the Nine commentary as well.
The way that's unbelievable.
That was a great.
I mean, because you think about how many great spinners have fallen at the sword here. It's peculiar.
Yeah, but it's been quite strange the way Mizbah's used him in that he's sort of been used as a bit of a stock bowler, bowling to the left-hand, has pitched a lot on leg stump. And he hasn't, you know, he's obviously not a huge turner of the ball either. So he's looking at on wickets that are a bit more up and down, you know, looking for a batsman to make a mistake. But in Australia, you've really got to attack as a spinner, I think, to take wickets.
You got to bowl a more aggressive line. I think you get the batsman driving more outside off stump.
Do you think he's affected by the fact that there are so many left-arm bowlers in the Pakistani side and he doesn't have those footmarks to pitch into?
When they're there, though, he doesn't use them that well. I mean, the ball that he got Maddison with, I couldn't believe that he didn't, you know, try bowling around the wicket to the left-handers more. You know, at least use some angle. Whereas he just bowled those sort of top spinning balls on leg stump a lot.
And Maddison pretty much yorked himself on that delivery anyway, didn't he?
Yeah.
It also could be possibly the last test matches for Misbah Al-Haq and Yunus Khan, so there could be a bit of history made at the SCG. Seems to be a popular venue for signing out of test cricket.
But, man, is that the point you make? Has all the fight gone out of this Pakistani team?
Yes.
But how does that happen? It's that, you know, they lasted
They've been getting smashed in New Zealand, and they've come here and they put up such a good fight at the Gabba. They look like they're in the Boxing Day test. I think it just must be hugely demoralising for them.
Oh, it
the
is way now,
the
yeah.
tour has gone off the rails. But I want to move on to an interesting subplot off the field. Now, we've seen some battles on the field, but we seem to be having a battle waging out between Steve Rickson and Darren Lehman. So Steve Rickson is the fielding coach for Pakistan, but also a noted coach of, you know, in Australia, coached New South Wales for many years, quite close to a lot of the current players. And then Darren Lehman. Now, this is what Lehman had to say about Rickson. I think he had a go at the coaching staff as well. It was nice of him to shake no one hands tonight after they lost, Lehman told BT Sport, the British broadcaster of Australian internationals. Maybe he should concentrate on them catching the ball better as the fielding coach. Their comments that you don't really have to say, but obviously has a gripe to bear against us. That's well within his right, but I'd be worried about them catching the ball. So that's Lehman throwing one at Rickson. Then Rickson returns serve by saying, I shook every player's hand and the manager's. It just happened that I didn't shake Lehman's hand because he was doing something else. Maybe Boof should do his homework better. I don't really care what people say. So I think there seems to be some tension about these coveted coaching roles.
This could handbags at 10 yards.
This could be this could be homework gate too, could it, Menace? Obviously, there's some history between the pair, isn't there? And I think I understand that Rickson was the sort of player that polarised.
Well, he was passed over as well for coaching jobs in Australia.
Yeah,
he's
true,
a bit sore
true.
About that. I think there's a real tension among coaches in Australia that work their way up the system and then ex-Australian players retire and then they get thrown at the top of the pecking order. And, you know, I can see that.
This is personal. It's obviously, it's emanating from their playing careers. I think this is personal and that's good.
Yeah, so there could be a bit of tension off the field. All right, predictions, guys. Are we all predicting an Aussie result at the SCG?
I can't say anything but probably a resounding Australian win, Menes, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd love to see Stephen O'Keefe take a bag full of wickets at his home ground.
So will I. But will
Steve Smith score 100 in his 50th
Will
test
O'Keefe
match?
Last the test? Will he break down again? Let's hope he doesn't.
Right, now let's move on to the commentary critique, the first one of 2017. Big news in Channel 9 box. Mark Nicholas has been withdrawn through to illness. Really, well, you know, he had to leave the ground a couple of times at the MCG. Very sad.
Any update as to what's actually wrong with him?
Well, it's very serious because when they don't actually announce what it is, you can tell it's pretty serious. Why are you guys laughing? You could have cancer and you're laughing about it.
There's some talk.
I'm not editing this bit out.
It's appendicitis at first.
Well, I think it's something more serious than that because your appendix either go or they don't they? So really sad. So Nico's out. You know, we don't know when he'll be back.
Who's going to host, Menes?
Michael Slater was in his absence in Melbourne.
We'll see what happens at the SCG test. And as Nico goes out, let's move on to the Big Bash commentary box because there's been some entries this year. I've seen Andrew Simons enter the box for the Big Bash. What do we think of Roy's entry? Because Channel 10 did him no favours by building him up as the funniest man on earth. So he had a lot to live up to.
It was going
to
be a combination of Richie Beno and Ricky Gervais, wasn't he? And they hyped it up too much, and Roy's, he's sort of irreverent a little bit, isn't he? But it's that dry sort of humour, and I think he struggles to keep it engaging, to keep it bubbling along.
He's a bit low energy, I think, at times.
The first night was him and Ricky Ponting, and I was almost falling asleep.
And that Queensland drawl is so strong that you almost need subtitles at times. He made a few good observations, but I think compared to the rest of that BBL commentary team, I think he's lacking.
I think he has gotten better then. I think that's part of it. You know, you obviously do get better as you go along. But last night or the night before I was listening, he did make some valuable insights into the game, I felt.
Yeah, I just thought it would built him up too much. He should have had a quiet entry into the box, a normal entry, and it would have been fine.
Yeah, you're right.
And when he was with Gilchrist and Fleming, I think the three of them were a good combo. Sort of they played off each other well. There's been some controversy in the Big Bash box. Started off with Ricky Ponting singing a song to Mark Waugh about him taking cash from a bookie back in the day. Very edgy from Punter. What do we think?
My favourite part of that is how they asked Mark Waugh if he remembered it, and he said, oh no, classic junior style. And then Ponting just had it on the top of his head. What a brilliant little performance that was. And didn't Mark Waugh just look absolutely and utterly devastated by it?
You can imagine.
Back in the day, Shane Lee, Brett Lee's older brother, used to whip the guitar out and play these songs for the team in the back room. So they probably know the words from that as much as anything.
Rick, imagine you're Ricky Ponting fielding down at deep backward square leg or something. You would have had the balmy army in your ear for half the day about that sort of stuff. But I just find it, I don't think Mark Waugh's he's not a great commentator either. I just find he gets too prickly. He doesn't have the personality.
He can't laugh at himself.
No, that's the other thing.
He takes himself too seriously, which I find surprising, because you think, you know, laconic bloke could have a bit of a giggle about himself. But then he did try and get Ricky Ponting back by singing to Ricky Ponting the song about Ponting getting punched at the Bourbon and Beefsteak. Now, I saw Junior preparing for this out the back at the Big Bash. He had his phone out and his glasses, and he was searching everywhere. And, just didn't have the same impact that Ricky Ponting's did, because the timing wasn't there, but good effort from Junior.
Yeah, well, good on him. Yeah.
Made a fair point. I mean, that was pretty funny when Ponting woke up with a black eye.
Yeah, but I tell you what, man, as Mark Waugh and KP, I was watching that little session of commentary, and didn't KP go hard at him? I felt uncomfortable watching it, and I don't know if KP was trying to be controversial, but he was pretty disrespectful to Mark Waugh.
Well, I've got a backstory to this, but I'll give you some of the lines Peterson gave to Mark Waugh. So Peterson started grilling Mark Waugh about being a national selector, and this is a couple of things he said. You missed a trick, Junior, like you did against South Africa. I'm surprised you still have a job, to be fair. Now, what I've noticed is there is an element in the Melbourne Stars personnel that really are behind Maxwell and not big fans of some of the selectors. And, you know, Peterson, Maxwell, Woodhill, all these blokes, if you go on social media, it's pretty obvious the way they're leaning. And Mark Waugh is in their sights as not being one of their favourite selectors. What do you guys think about, A, that exchange between KP and Mark Waugh, and if Mark Waugh is a selector?
Well, I think KP is probably echoing, to go on to point B, I think KP is probably echoing the thoughts of a lot of fans there, that wondering sort of what has Mark Waugh added to the selection panel since he's been here. You know, obviously they made a massive hash of things at the start of the summer, and just because we've beaten a lackluster, dispirited Pakistani side since then, hasn't righted the ship. I don't think Mark Waugh's the man there.
Some of the questions are, does he have a New South Wales bias? Does he watch enough cricket?
I don't think he does. I think that's the problem, Joe and Mendes. I think he doesn't watch as much cricket, or he doesn't have that perhaps innate understanding or feel perhaps that...
He played 100 tests for Australia.
I have to disagree. I mean, he's as...
One of your favourite players, Joe.
He's my
I'm saying feel as a selector, not as a player.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the bigger question
Joe's
is what are they going to do with the chairman position? Because I think Trevor Holmes is still in as a interim capacity. So that, and now, you know, Ponting has been taken into a coaching role. Is that, do you think Holmes will get the job full time?
I don't think so, but neither. I think KP could probably put himself up for the job.
Can you imagine?
He's commentating in both networks. He's playing. Why not select?
But man, you've said before, why is Greg Chappell there? Because he came, and this is brought up on the radio again this week, And I think Mike Hussey was talking about it and saying that Greg Chappell bought in all these silly things about, like, your favourite...
what they've done to Shield Cricket CA and 11 Futures and, 11
yeah,
and
the
all
futures,
this stuff.
And then how that just, you know, affected everything. That these guys should have been playing in grade cricket instead of playing in these other games. And Greg Chappell was a part of that. So there needs to be a big rethink.
It certainly does. I think cracker Trevor Holmes is a good chairman at the moment. He's got that experience. So, but do we like KP giving it to Mark Waugh? Because it got a bit uncomfortable, because you could tell Mark Waugh didn't take it too well. And then, you know, you could just tell it wasn't a fun exchange, was it? But do you think it was good television?
I've said before, and I'll say it again, I know I bag KP a little bit. What I do like about KP is he does offer an opinion. He does have a crack at someone, whoever it is, Mark Waugh or whoever, you know, player or selector or whatever. He has a crack. He has an opinion. He's not afraid to share that, which is... unlike a lot of his fellow commentators. That's what I like about him.
Well, he has the outsider's kind of take on things and says things that people who are in the Aussie setup, you know, won't say. But I think he overstepped the mark the other night. I think to say to a bloke who's sitting next to you, you shouldn't have your job anymore when you're a visitor in the country is a bit much. And we know that KP acts like a bit of a galah from time to time anyway, so...
yeah, not just the fact that KP's a visitor, but also Mark Waugh's not there to answer questions about his selections.
Well, this is the conflict of interest question. Exactly. Should a national selector be a commentator anyway? And
probably
if he is,
not.
No, I don't think he should.
It probably doesn't look good. The Big Bash, you can kind of get away with it because it's that informal style. But you can imagine Trevor Holmes was commentating, you know, on the Sydney Test. There'd be outrage.
Well, Menes, there was another night when Howie was pressing, said to Waugh, I'm going to press you on some selections or...
get off the fence.
Yeah, and Mark Waugh again looked very uncomfortable, became very uncomfortable and just clammed up. And if he's there, well, he's got to offer an opinion. He's got to answer these questions. He's been paid to do so. He shouldn't be doing it.
Well, I'm not sure. It's hard when you look at these private discussions between the selectors and then you have to filter out what's appropriate for public consumption.
Why? Because Rod Marsh couldn't do that?
Rod Marsh certainly couldn't do that. He was a muppet at that.
Yeah, and interesting comments from this week from David Saker, speaking a little bit out of turn as well. Yep. On the all-rounder position. So, yeah, look...
So Saker came out and said he thinks that there's a lot of pressure being put on the bowlers at the moment and that we need that fifth bowling option. And there was two question marks out of that is, why was Saker put up to talk in the first place? Because it's either a player or a coach, as you know, Macca. It's not usually the assistant coach. So there must have been something there.
I think it was probably a day when nothing much happened. Was it? Who are we going to put up?
It rained a lot and everything, but yeah. Saker was a bad one.
I think he
could have been. It could have been a planned move.
That's what I was about. I reckon Lehman maybe put him up to it to put a bit of pressure on the other selectors because they felt like they really needed it.
But this is all getting very Machiavellian in the back rooms of the Australian cricket team. Let's move on. Last bit of commentary critique before we end this segment. I was on the way home from work and I just timed it. So I was in the car for when Australia wrapped up the test in Melbourne on Boxing Day. So I listened to the last wicket on Triple M and Gus Warland happened to be calling the last wicket in Australia's famous victory. And actually, I'll give raps to Gus Warland. He did get the hairs going on the back of the neck because it was just so emotional and he was so passionate and that energy came through that I really enjoyed. I know you can get that with other commentators, but Gus Warland delivered on that moment. I'm sure a dream for him calling an Aussie victory. Mac, I haven't had you on the show since Triple M made a foray into Test cricket commentary. How have you found Triple M?
Well, man, I think you've hit the nail on the head there that, you know, that I think they do. Triple M for me does bring this great energy and they look at it through different eyes and I think they're generally humbled and excited to be covering Test cricket. I know it can be a little bit blokey sometimes, but I think you're right that enthusiasm really shines through. And you know, early on when I started listening to Triple M, I sort of thought, oh god, this is a bit he wasn't calling, somebody else was calling. But Warland gets on there and you know, he'll speak.
Brayshaw.
Well, no. You know, and Warland is also a bit self-deprecating. And, he, you know, I mean, he's got some kudos. He's an experienced media operator now. And he says, said to Merv, I'm just happy that you know my name. I'm, you know, it's an honour to be here. And I think that really comes through, which is something I really like, which is, you know, I think ABC, I wonder who listens to the ABC now, Menes, because Even older guys, older than us, well, not that we're old, but you know.
I've stopped. I used to religiously listen to the 702 or to ABC Grandstand when it was Robes and Jimmy and Skull. But I have to say, you know, to the counterpoint to Triple M being really blokey, I've been very impressed with the commentary of Isha Gua. I think she's phenomenal. One of the better callers I've heard. Did you catch any of her sessions?
Yeah, it's interesting because I was on another podcast and the person I was on gave her a scathing review as being one of the worst commentators over in the Caribbean Premier League. So I wasn't expecting much, but I think you're right. She's done a really good job. I really enjoy Nerilee Meadows' commentary. So yeah, I think bring it on.
I think Isha struggled at first with that environment where she had, you know, they've got four callers, four people on the, behind the mic, and you've got a comedian there as well.
Who's is it, Mick Malloy, George Schiller.
Yeah, and Mick Malloy, as we all know, he just plucks something out of the sky and brings it up. So it's hard to sort of go on the run, but I think Isha really adapted to that well. Yeah, but for mine, Gus Wallen, I really enjoyed his commentary. I thought it was fantastic. But, you know, I found myself listening to them. I found myself listening to Macquarie, and I don't know why I'd go back to ABC.
I find the Grandstand really sort of boring. It is. Flat now. I don't know if you agree,
terrible.
Manners.
Kadich, Rogers, Nanis. But if you turn across the Macquarie radio, I think they have a really good setup. Tim Lane, Beaver. And Ian Chappell is someone that seems to come alive more on the radio for me. I don't know what it is, but to me, he's better to listen to on the radio.
But, mate, Mike Hussey as well. I mean, he got panned on Channel 9 for being wooden, but on radio he was very, very forthcoming, had some great anecdotes. I think it really, you know, and he's someone who's just started out, but he was fantastic, I thought, on the radio. And you're right, with Chappelli, it really, really suited him, I thought.
Well, I think that's our first commentary critique of 2017. I'm sure there'll be plenty more to come this year. Before we move on, I just want to announce the Have a Go Your Mug mug promotion. Now, remember, please go on iTunes or whatever app you listen to the show on and leave a review for the Australian Cricket Podcast. When you do that, email me so I can see that you've done a review, because I can only really see the Australian iTunes and not all the apps. And then if you do leave a review, you will go in the drawer for a Have a Go Your Mug mug. Macca, you gave yours away, still in my bad books.
I'd love another one, please.
When you get a big guest, you can have one. So if that's too complicated, you please subscribe to the show on Patreon for $5 a month or more, and you'll get a mug straight away. Thank you so much to all the subscribers on Patreon for your continued support. And this week, we do not have a draw for the Have a Go Your Mug mug because been off for the week. So get some reviews in, then we'll have a draw for the next episode. And as ever, if you want to get in touch with the Australian Cricket Podcast, email us at auscricketpod, auscricketpod@gmail.com.
Tate. It's four. Oh, it's madness. Wow. Chris Lynn has taken the wild thing and sent him possibly under the roof.
It's on the roof.
Look at the look on his face. He's just, well, that's what I do. It was at 148 kilometres an hour on the Optus speedometer.
My days.
Even the wild thing's gone, well, I can't do much about that.
Welcome back to the Australian Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel. I'm here with Joe and Macca. And that was Chris Linsanity Lynn hitting a ball out of the Gabba. And those of you who haven't seen it, go on the internet and look for Chris Lynn hitting one about 180 metres out of the Gabba. It was phenomenal stuff. And what have you two thought of the Big Bash so far this summer?
Man, as I still really enjoy the Big Bash, of course I do, but I do get the feeling that it's plateauing. I mean, last year it just blew up, didn't it? But now I just feel like, and you know, maybe it's found its feet, it's found its place in the Australian summer and the Australian sporting landscape, but I think it's just started to plateau. You look at the crowd at the MCG, it wasn't as big. The crowd at for obviously the derby, the crowd at Adelaide Oval for New Year's Eve wasn't as big. I think it's starting to
your
plateau. Are you shaking your head here?
You're typical journalist. Looking for negative angle to find the story. I mean, the only reason it's plateauing is because they can't fit any more people in the stadiums. I mean, what are you going to do? Hanging off the roof at the Gabba next time? It was a full house.
Yeah, I mean, as I know that they've talked about the next stage of evolution potentially being having more international players come in. And I think, you know, back to your point about Chris Lynn, I think it is a phenomenal, I guess, stage for emerging Australian cricketers at the moment who wouldn't have their name up in lights were it not for the BBL. And, you know, I think about somebody like Chris Lynn and, you know, David Warner went from being a T20 player to a test opener. So how do you feel about potentially more international being introduced into the lineup? Or do you like the fact that it has a strong Australian flavour to it?
I like the fact that it has a strong Australian flavour to it. And actually, for the Big Smash Cricket podcast, we interviewed Ryan Carters and we asked him questions about this. And he said how important it is for these players now to play in these high-stakes games. You think about it before, you know, if they got picked for Australia and they walk out to a packed MCG, they would have never played in a big crowd before. But now someone like Chris Lynn, if he does that for Australia, he's hit sixes in front of 50,000 people a lot of times.
It must have absolutely transformed the lives of fringe first-class players. Like, you think about Rob Quiney, who's been playing in Melbourne grade cricket, and then comes out and plays this great knock in front of, you know, a huge crowd. Not only does it put his sort of bona fide back in front of the selectors, but I'm sure it's transformed a lot of their bank accounts too. So I think to your question about has it reached its peak, or Macca's point about has it reached its peak, I think there's still growth in it.
I mean, the Cricket Australia have been talked about expanding the competition, more games, more teams.
I'll put my journalist hat on here again. I think that's just talk. Where could you put have another team? I don't see.
Okay, if you couldn't put another team, at least you could play every team twice.
Your man Andy Maguire came out today and cautioned against that. But
I'd like to see each team play each other twice. So at the moment, it's an 8-team comp with every team playing each other once, and then you play your closest rival twice. Well, I'd like to see that move to a straight. You play home and away every side.
The only problem I have with that is that sometimes for me personally, with the IPL, that it does drag on a bit too long. There's that time when you're sort of waiting for the finals to come when they're still playing pool matches. I think it can drag on too much. But
well, you've given me a good segue then into the ladder. Let's just have a quick ladder update on the Big Bash. This ladder update brought to you from the Big Smash Cricket Podcast. If you haven't already done it, go and subscribe to the Big Smash Cricket Podcast. That's me and Paul's podcast all about the Big Bash. So leading the way so far is the Perth Scorchers with 3 wins from their 4 matches. Now, Mackie, you've got the Brisbane Heat as your favourite. They've three
undefeated
matches, 3 wins. They look really good to me. I think they're going to be hard to beat.
I can't see them getting beat, man. As you look at that batting lineup, I just can't see it getting beat. Obviously, they rely relatively heavily on Lynn, and when they failed in the past, he hasn't, you know, come to the party, but I can't see them getting beat. But I know you like the Renegades.
Yeah, the Renegades Hogs are third. They've got them. 3 games, 2 wins, 1 loss. I think that those top 3, Scorchers, Heat and Renegades, are going to figure in the finals. The unfortunate thing about the Renegades is Dwayne Bravo is out of the rest of the tournament, so there's a little bit of a hole there that they now need to fill.
And as I think for me, one of the things about the Big Bash, it needs a strong Sydney team. And you look at the start when the Sixers were the out-and-out team. And I know you're going to say this is Sydney bias, and I know you say this is New South Wales bias, but it needs a strong Sydney team for us.
Well, you're not going to get that from the Thunder this year. No, they're 0 from 4.
I know, but
how many games did they win the Big Bash? They won, like, a few games last year to win the title. They didn't win any before that. They must have won under a dozen games in
your
the whole
homework
history.
For next week, man, get their winning percentage.
I enjoyed writing some of these stories back in the day, but if you remember, they went across 3 seasons they didn't win a game because I think it was in BBL 2, whenever it was, they went across 3 seasons and they didn't win a game.
Those drop catches, I know you would have covered this in detail in the Big Smash matters, but I don't think I've ever seen 3 or 4 drop catches that were that easy in a game of top-class cricket.
Well, as we've talked about, sometimes they do enjoy, what is it, Schadenfreude?
Yes.
So I was out at Spotless, and I predicted before the Big Bash started that the Thunder wouldn't win a game. And then to watch them implode in front of their home fans, where it looked like they were going to beat the Heat, and then all of a sudden Chris Lynn starts whacking them, they start going to pieces, the crowd starts getting on them and angry. I have to say, it did kind of derive some joy.
And I have to say, that slightly bemused and embarrassed look on Watto's face, it's something we've seen so many times throughout the years.
He tried to pretend like he didn't see it, but then he realised he couldn't. I don't know, he made
Watto,
some face
Watto.
That, oh, I didn't see it.
You know how he is when he gets caught plum LBW and it's someone else's fault. You know,
Andre Russell's been really disappointing for the Thunder.
What about that perennial limp?
I think he's just here for a paycheck. You know, without the He needs money to keep him on the field.
There's big question marks that haven't been answered about Russell, aren't there?
And big question marks. Yeah. So the Big Bash is heating up. As I said, download the Big Smash Cricket podcast. You can get all your news and insights there. And I just want to end this show with some news in the coaching ranks for the Australian team, because I think this is a really interesting run. We talked about Rickson and Lehman fighting it out in the coaching ranks. Now we could see a three-way fight for Lehman's successor. So Justin Langer has been appointed as the T20 coach for this T20A series, I'm calling it, the end of the summer v Sri Lanka.
You should get your CA11 in there too.
Or the Big Bash League All-Stars. I've got a few different names for it. But then his two assistants are Jason Gillespie and Ricky Ponting. Now, all three of these blokes, Langer, Gillespie and Ponting, have been mooted at different times as the next Australian coach. Guys, who of these three would you like to see coaching the Australian side in a couple of years when Boof hangs up the coaching hat?
Well, man, as you see it in some football codes. I think you may see the situation where you might have co-coaches, or you know, Dizzy will be a bowling coach and Ponting will be a batting coach.
Have you turned from journalist to politician where you're not answering the question? When have they appointed two leaders to anything? Goes back to like the US office where they decided to give two general managers and it was a disaster. I mean,
I could give you a rugby league example, but I know you don't want that. I just think, well, let's go back to Langer though.
One of these would you like to see as the head coach?
Ricky Ponting.
That's a good answer. Why?
he loves it. He wants to get involved. He's got the track record before him, but he's also got a great feel, a great affinity for the game. And I think he's someone who can bring on those younger players who can forge a great belief in the team, but also teach skills across the board, you know, fielding and batting, because he was so good at both. And I don't think he's one of those players who was just good about it like Lara and didn't think about it. He really had that natural talent, but he just as much put in the effort, you know.
You've never been a Langer fan. What about you?
Either of you.
Well, interesting.
That's not as bad as you.
Interestingly, Ricky beat Shane Warne, who had been putting his hand up for that assistant role.
No one takes Warney seriously. Come on, Joe.
Into that. But out of those
can
three...
You can't give Warne another forum for saying outrageous stuff. Can you imagine if he was the coach? He'd have Maxwell and all his mates opening. Darren Berry would be keeping. Hodge would be opening the batting.
Chasing supermodels
Did
around.
Did you hear what he said about Stephen O'Keefe in the Channel 9 commentary? It was outrageous. He called him a white ball specialist. I mean, that is just... I think that's lacking credibility in a way.
Exactly.
To get back,
the hair dye's got to his head.
To get back to your question, Manners, Ricky Ponting is an interesting one, because on the one hand, I think we have failed to get the very best of our retired Test players and, you know, the Pontings of the world into the top coaching positions. But let's not look at Ricky Ponting with rose-coloured glasses and think about him, you know, as the insightful BBL commentator. He struggled with tactics as a captain, and is that the guy you want kind of riding shotgun in the Australian Test team? And he was he was just the most incredible leader in terms of setting the example. But he got a few pretty major tactical things wrong in his captaining career. So that's the one question mark I have over him.
He has had a lot of success in the IPL coaching Mumbai, but you counter that with the continued success Jason Gillespie had in Yorkshire, Justin Langer's had over in Western Australia. Those two have really put in the hard work as coaches. So Ponting maybe needs to go away and coach a Shield side for a year and just prove to everybody that he's got the coaching qualifications, perhaps.
For mine, I just think that Ricky is taken a step back. He's probably, I don't know if he's eaten a piece of humble pie, but he's realised that he has to do some work. He really wants to be a coach and he has to do that. I think he probably has accepted his shortcomings or what shortcomings he had and embraced those. And, you know, he knows he's got a lot of work to do. But, man, as I also want to talk about Langer. So he unceremoniously booted Bradley Hogg, your man, from his Scorcher side, didn't he? And to all and sundry, Bradley Hogg has definitely not lost it. What does that tell you about Langer?
There is a rationale behind it, though. It'll be impossible for him to go on too much longer at mid-40s. And so he was trying to free up a spot for one of their...
I mean, he's got Agar, Turner, Mitch Marsh, all these great young players over at Perth. Maybe he wants them to play in every game.
I mean, there was a similar thing in the AFL this year with Boomer Harvey, who got retired, who was still performing incredibly well in his mid-40s. So I think there comes a time when you've got to make a call on everybody.
What's AFL, Menes?
I don't know. I think it's a good time to end the podcast. Throw in AFL analogies. Everyone will be turning off, no doubt. Well, Joe Macca, thanks so much for coming in for the first Australian cricket podcast of 2017. A big year of cricket ahead. I can't wait. I hope you guys are as excited as I am about a lot of cricket ahead.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's been very enjoyable.
Thanks, Joe. Happy New Year, everyone. We'll be back next week.
A few different ones from Warnie, didn't they, over the years?
Yeah. I think I scored one too at one stage.
What was yours all about?
Oh, I can't. I've tried to forget it, actually.
Right.
I just can't remember.
They have one for you, Rick.
Mark Waugh is an Aussie. He wears a baggy hat. When he saw the bookies cash, he said, I'm having that.
He got a good memory.
Shared it out with Warnie. They went and had some beers. And when the OCB found out, they covered up for years. Oh, Mark Waugh is
an You know, word for word. You are kidding.
That is the moment of the Big Bash Mine. Ricky Ponting singing. We need to turn around and get the Arias tuned in. Three overs done. None for 29.